Imagine a quiet summer day in a small Canadian town, say 1914. You might hear, I don't know, a train in the distance, leaves rustling, just everyday sounds.
The usual hum of life.
Exactly. For the folks in Pontiac County, Quebec, that was their reality. And then bam, suddenly that quiet is just shattered. Jarring headlines in the local paper.
And that image, it isn't just nostalgia, is it? That's pretty much exactly what happened as the world just tipped into war.
It really is. Today, we're doing a deep dive into that exact moment, those first few weeks of World War I.
But not from the usual angle, right? Not the big European battles, not the politicians making grand pronouncements.
No, we're looking at it through a really unique lens, the eyes of the ordinary people living in Pontiac through their local paper, The Equity.
It's an amazing source.
Yeah.
These weekly issues from August and September 1914, like a time capsule.
Totally. Not just dry facts. It's this incredible window, isn't it? You see how this huge global conflict starts rippling through this, well, seemingly small community.
And it's all mixed together. Headlines about war in Europe, right next to, local gossip, ads for the hardware store, people's personal worries.
It's such a fascinating blend. So our mission today is to really pull out the key insights from these papers.
Yeah, what were people in Pontiac actually reading? How did their world change, like overnight? And what did it even mean to be Canadian right then as the Great War kicked off?
Think of this as your shortcut, maybe, to getting a real feel for a specific, often overlooked part of this huge historical moment.
All seen through the eyes of this one Canadian community trying to make sense of it all. It's going to be quite the story.
Okay, so let's dive in. Early August 1914, the world's on fire in Europe, but you look at The Equity from August 6th.
And it still feels remarkably local, doesn't
It
it?
really does. There's talk of a lawn social for the Union Church, personal notes like Miss Ion coming back from vacation, or Mr. Smith, the bank manager, off holidaying at Eagle Lake.
It's quite something, that contrast. Everyday life chugging along, but you can feel these like tremors of the global crisis underneath.
So what do you think that tells us? Were people just trying to hold on to normal life? Or maybe hadn't grasped the scale yet.
It's probably a bit of both,
Yeah.
The really big, scary headlines weren't quite there on the 6th, but the tension definitely present.
And The Equity picks up on it, even subtly.
Right. There's this one article, American Papers on British Attitude and Naval Situation. That's quite telling.
How so?
Well, it immediately brings the global stakes right to their doorstep, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Focusing on the Navy and, crucially, Canada's own defense, or maybe lack thereof.
Right. Almost like the paper's using this outside perspective to sort of prime its readers for what's coming, hinting at the pressure on Britain.
Exactly. And it doesn't pull any punches about Canada's position.
No, it calls it the humiliating position of Canada, a wealthy young country totally dependent on the motherland Britain for naval defense. That's pretty blunt.
It is. And then it hits them with the numbers, the
Yep.
spending difference.
Yeah, the UK is spending about 35 shillings per person on the military.
Which was a lot of money back then for an average family.
And Canada, a tiny fraction, just 6 shillings 8 pence per head.
It makes it really clear who's footing the bill for imperial defense, right? It's not just politics, it's economics hitting the average British taxpayer hard.
The article even compares it to Germany, doesn't it?
It does. Germany, the main rival, spending only 7 shillings per person on their navy, while the UK is carrying this huge burden of 22 shillings per head just for the navy.
That's a massive difference, like 3 times the burden on a British person compared to a German one.
Yeah, and the paper points out this competition in armaments is heavily bearing on the British people. It really brings home the cost, the strain, even before the war really explodes.
For someone reading this in Pontiac, maybe feeling a bit removed from it all, those numbers must have made it feel much more real. Not just politics, but a huge financial weight.
Absolutely. It frames the whole thing as this massive, maybe unsustainable financial drain on the empire.
Okay, so fast forward just 1 week, August 13th. The tone shifts completely.
Oh, yeah. No more subtle undercurrents. It's explicit. War is here.
The Equity lays it out plain. Austria and Germany are now at war with Britain, France, Russia, Serbia, and Montenegro. And Japan's in too, defending British interests in Asia.
The lines are drawn. The scale is suddenly immense. Imagine reading that over your morning coffee in Shawville. The world just changed.
And there's key strategic news too, right? Italy's staying out.
Yes, that's huge. Germany tried to pressure Italy to join them, as part of the Triple Alliance.
With Austria-Hungary.
Right. But Italy refused. That was a big blow to the Central Powers right at the start, a diplomatic win for the Allies.
And the paper also reports the first naval action.
the British Admiralty announces a German submarine attacked a cruiser squadron. No British losses, but they sunk a German sub.
So right away, confirmation that this war is happening at sea, too, and under it, submarines. That's a whole new terrifying thing.
A new dimension to warfare, absolutely.
Speaking of the sea, let's talk about Canada's own first steps. Mobilization, the economy. How did that look in the equity?
Well, the August 13th issue goes into detail about Canada's response. It's incredibly fast.
The first contingent assembling at Valcartier, that's near Quebec City, right?
Yeah, a huge new training camp set up almost overnight. The paper says 14,000 men and 6,000 horses are already there, training for active service overseas.
14,000? And they expected way more, didn't they? Up to 32,000.
Or even more, yeah. The scale of mobilization is just staggering. Think about the logistics of that. It shows this immediate, powerful commitment to Britain.
And Canada's making moves on the naval front, too, in a pretty unique way.
Yeah, that's a great story. Canada buys 2 Turkey submarine craft.
Subs meant for Turkey.
Exactly. The CC-1 and CC-2 snapped them up quickly, manned them with reservists. The idea was they'd provide valuable defense against German raiders on the coast.
So a bit opportunistic, maybe, but practical. Addressing that vulnerability we talked about earlier.
Very practical. Shows they weren't just waiting around.
And it wasn't just about soldiers, was it? The economy felt the impact right away.
Oh, definitely. That August 6th issue already mentioned the need for harvest workers out west.
Right. At least 15,000 men needed for the crops. Provincial governments, the CPR, everyone's worried about the harvest.
And that's crucial, right? Not just feeding Canada, but feeding Britain, too. Food supply was going to be critical.
So they understood the economic side of this war immediately.
And they acted on it. By August 13th, the Equity is talking about the harvesters' excursions.
What were those exactly?
Special trains, basically.
Yeah.
Taking men from Ontario and Quebec out to the prairies, Winnipeg, Moose Jaw.
To help bring in the crops?
Yep. They even mentioned the rate, 0.5 cent per mile. Standard stuff for these excursions, but vital now. Big crops expected. Need the manpower.
So the war creates this immediate domestic labor demand in farming. Fascinating how interconnected it all is. It
really is. A global conflict boosting jobs in Saskatchewan.
So with all this huge stuff happening, war declared, troops mobilizing, economies shifting, what was life actually like day to day in Pontiac? Did everything just stop?
Well, judging by the paper, not at all. The local economy seems to just keep going. Especially in those early August issues.
You still see the big ads for the banks, the Bank of Ottawa, the Merchants Bank of Canada.
Yep. And the hardware store, still prominent. Plus those little classifieds, you know, for sale, Clyde Mayer Colt or a single buggy, everyday transactions.
It shows a certain resilience, maybe, or just inertia.
Probably a bit of both. Yeah. People still needed sugar, Redpath, sugar ads are in there. Still needed baking magic baking powder, too. Life's basics don't stop for a war overseas.
That's true. And things like education.
Still happening. There's a notice for Willis College prepping students for business, shorthand, civil service jobs. Career aspirations are still alive for some.
Which seems almost jarring next to the news about young men heading off to fight.
It really is a stark contrast.
And the social life. The small town stuff.
That continues, too, at least initially. That August 6th paper mentions the lawn social for the church, people coming back from holidays.
Like Miss Isle and Mr. Smith.
Exactly. It feels like summer carrying on, almost defiantly normal. Like the outside world hadn't fully crashed the party yet.
But reality does intrude, even in the local notes.
Oh, for sure. There are obituaries, like for Mr. W.J. O'Mara on August 6th, a reminder that the rhythms of life and death continue locally, regardless of global events.
And even local government is just ticking along.
Seems like it. There's a public notice about the valuation roll for Clarendon Municipality on August 13th. Taxes still need collecting. Councils still need to meet. The basic machinery of the town keeps turning.
Providing maybe a sense of stability when everything else felt like it was tipping over?
I think that's exactly right. That routine becomes really important.
Okay, let's move into mid to late August. The war has been going on for a few weeks. How does the news change in the Equity?
It definitely gets darker. More harrowing reports start coming in from Europe.
Like the fall of Louvain. That sounds awful from the description in the August 20th issue.
It was. The paper calls it the beautiful city of Louvain and says it was utterly destroyed by the Germans as a reprisal against civilians.
That feels like a real turning point in the narrative, doesn't it? From strategy and alliances to just brutal destruction targeting civilians.
Absolutely. And the language used is powerful. Priceless relics of antiquity, leveled to the ground by these modern Goths and Vandals.
Goths and Vandals. Wow.
They even remind readers of Louvain's history, a major industrial center hundreds of years ago. So this isn't just destruction. It's framed as an attack on civilization itself, pure barbarism, designed to shock and anger readers back home.
And while Louvain shows the human costs, the paper still tracks the military movements, right?
Yeah, briefly. The August 27th issue mentions the German advance and the French frontier. Just glimpses that the fighting on land is ongoing, the lines are shifting, adds to the uncertainty, I imagine.
Definitely. And the paper also dives into another terrifying aspect of the war, those submarine mines.
Right, August 20th again. Called the most treacherous mode of warfare.
Yep.
And they really explain them.
They break it down. Controllable versus uncontrollable mines.
Exactly. The controllable ones, fired electrically from shore, can be turned off. The uncontrollable ones are mechanical, self-contained, go off on contact. It's like a little tech explainer for readers.
Trying to help people understand these new, scary weapons.
For sure. They talk about how they're used narrowing channels, good in fog. Even mention the Russo-Japanese War, Port Arthur, as an example.
Bringing it back to recent history, but what about the ethics? How does the paper handle that?
That's really interesting. It presents both sides. Some see mines as totally treacherous, indiscriminate killers, right? Hurting civilians long after a battle.
Yeah, makes sense.
But others argue they're necessary for defense, even humane. Maybe because they could stop an enemy without a bloody fight.
Humane. Wow, that's a take.
It shows people grappling with the morality of new weapons in real time, doesn't it? Before all the rules and conventions were figured out.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking of resources, the paper mentions Germany's war chest.
Uh-huh. The gold in the Spandau Tower. But then it adds this little dig.
That it would only last a day and a half in a real war.
Exactly. Kind of questioning Germany's financial staying power right there. Planting a seed of doubt for the readers.
So while Europe's dealing with all this, how is the Canadian home front adapting? What's the equity telling people?
Well, Canada's definitely stepping up its support. The August 20th issue announces something big. Canada is to send Great Britain 1 million bags of flour.
1 million bags? That's huge.
It is. Following Manitoba's lead, the paper says, it shows Canada immediately taking on this role as a vital supplier for Britain. Not just soldiers, but food. Essential stuff.
Part of the imperial war effort, economically speaking.
Precisely. And that has knock-on effects here, like in canning factories.
Ah, right, because imports from Europe were cut off.
Exactly. France and Belgium aren't shipping canned goods anymore, so the August 20th paper expects Canadian canning factories to ramp up production, creating jobs.
And it mentions something about who used to work there.
Yeah, that many previous employees weren't permanent residents. So it implies new jobs opening up for Canadians, specifically because of the war. Little demographic shifts starting already.
But it wasn't all good news economically, was it? The fur trade took a hit.
A big hit. London reports in that same August 20th issue talk about the disastrous effect on the fur trade.
And the impact on Indigenous communities.
Devastating. Thousands in the far north left without means of subsistence. The government had to step in to help. It shows how far the war's economic ripples reached, even into the most remote areas tied to global markets.
A stark reminder. Meanwhile, the military side keeps growing.
Oh, yeah. The August 27th paper confirms the numbers at Valcartier are now over 32,000.
Wow, that's double what they reported just 2 weeks earlier.
Keeps the scale of the national effort front and center for readers. Maybe encourages more enlistment too, you know.
Makes sense. But even with all that, local life in Pontiac seems incredibly normal sometimes.
Oh, it really does. The August 27th issue has a notice about the Homemakers Club meeting in September. They're having a demonstration on how to dress a chicken properly.
Seriously? Dressing fowl amidst a world war.
It sounds funny, but it speaks volumes, doesn't it? Local life, practical skills, social clubs, they mattered. Maybe they were an anchor.
I guess so. And big community events were still planned.
Absolutely. The Central Canada Exhibition in Ottawa, that's the big fair, is advertised heavily in late August for September.
So the fair's still on. Livestock shows, poultry.
All of it. Plus entertainment, Wild West shows, and even a night military display.
Ah, interesting. The war creeping into the entertainment, too. Blending the spectacle with the traditional fare.
Exactly. And local businesses keep advertising the essentials. H.S. Eliot and Sons offering pumps and well repairs. Basic services keeping the community running.
And then there's that weird bit, the mysterious airship sightings.
Oh, yeah. That's fascinating. Reported on August 27th, an airship seen near Ottawa, then again further down the canal. This one supposedly had a searchlight.
And someone saw something in Clarendon, too. South of Shawville.
Right, a reputable resident. Saw a light, heard an engine like a motorboat.
What do you make of that? Just jitters. Fear of Zeppelins.
It's got to be partly that, right? New technology, wartime anxiety. Zeppelins were the terrifying new weapon, so any strange light in the sky could feel like the enemy overhead, even way out in rural Quebec.
Whether it was real or not, the fact it's reported says a lot about the mood.
Totally. A heightened awareness, maybe a subconscious fear the war could literally land on their doorstep.
Okay, so we're into early September now, a month into the war. How is the bigger picture looking in the equity?
We start seeing reports about major troop movements and alliance strengthening.
Like the Russians arriving in France.
Yeah. Big news in the September 3rd and 10th issues. Reports claim 70,000 Russian troops have reached France, supposedly shipped via Scotland and England.
70,000. That's an incredible logistical feat, if true. The paper mentions eyewitness accounts.
It does, adding some weight to it. But, interestingly, there's also skepticism reported. Yeah, the Tribune's correspondent in Copenhagen apparently questioned the numbers, suggested maybe reports of German casualties over 100,000 killed were more significant.
So even back then, you're seeing conflicting reports, maybe propaganda, the fog of war, clouding the real picture.
Absolutely. Readers in Pontiac are getting different stories, trying to figure out what's really happening, just like we do today with information overload.
But one piece of news seems solid and really important for the Allies.
The agreement between Britain, France, and Russia, reported September 10th.
What did they agree to?
Basically, not to make a separate peace. They committed to fighting together during the present war. A huge step in cementing the alliance. It signaled this was likely going to be a long haul. They were in it together.
No easy way out for any one country. Yeah. And the money side becomes clearer, too.
Definitely. The September 3rd issue dives into the gold and silver reserves of the main banks. Britain, France, Germany, Austria, Hungary, right before the war started.
Laying out the financial firepower.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
It shows who had been building up reserves. France and Germany saw big increases while Britain was stable and Austria-Hungary lagged behind. It paints a picture of financial readiness, or lack thereof.
Underscoring that this war would be incredibly expensive. A war of resources, not just armies.
For sure. Readers would grasp the immense cost, maybe wonder about the future strain on Canada, too. And on the ground, the fighting seems intense, but back and forth.
Yeah, reports mention Germans taking key French towns like Lille and Roubaix, but then being driven back by the Allies, that classic early war seesaw battle.
Rapid advances, rapid retreats, lots of movement.
But then the equity offers this really striking insight into how the fighting itself is changing, September 3rd. The spade is as important as the rifle.
That line just cuts right through, doesn't it? It signals the end of old-style warfare, that dashing personal heroism.
So what does it mean, digging in?
Exactly. It's the dawn of trench warfare. The article talks about artillery field guns firing shrapnel shells constantly, 10 a minute, each bursting into hundreds of projectiles.
Yeah.
Totally. And infantry tactics, not mass charges. It describes soldiers getting up in small groups, running low, dodging, using the terrain. Digging for cover becomes essential.
A less glamorous, much grimmer kind of fighting.
Brutally effective, though.
Yeah.
And the paper contrasts old and new weapons again on September 10th.
Talking about bayonets versus bullets.
Yeah. Bayonets and saber charges, causing hideous wounds, are called medieval. Modern bullets, it argues, are almost merciful, kill quickly, or make a wound that heals better.
That's such a chillingly practical way to look at it, like an efficiency report on killing.
It is. Reflects this attempt to rationalize the new lethality. But there's also a positive development noted, surprisingly.
Oh, what's that?
Sanitation and disease.
Yeah.
September 3rd issue makes a big point. In this war, maybe only 3 will die of disease for everyone killed in battle.
Which was a huge improvement, right? Disease used to kill way more soldiers than fighting.
Exactly. The paper stresses that ignoring sanitation is now seen as suicidal by major powers. A crucial lesson learned about military public health.
So, even amidst the horror, there are signs of progress in some areas. But back in Pontiac, life goes on.
It really does. The Equity keeps reporting on local happenings. September 3rd, there's a report on an Orange Lodge meeting.
The Protestant fraternal group, big in Canada back then?
Right. The Grand Master of Quebec spoke. But interestingly, the turnout wasn't great.
Why not?
The paper suggests maybe harvesting kept people busy or other things, but the speech itself was seen as interesting.
So local priorities, like farming, still competed with the war for people's attention.
Seems like it. And the biggest local event, the Shawville Fair, is still very much on, advertised heavily for late September.
The fair. With prize money for cows and crops and everything.
Yep. a major sign of normalcy, of tradition continuing, must have been quite reassuring for the community.
And the local businesses are still advertising.
Consistently. H.S. Eliot still fixing wells. Archie Dover selling farm machinery. The Shawville Meat Shop offering fresh meat. It's the pulse of the local economy, still beating.
People need these things, war or no war.
And they need groceries. Redpath sugar, Magic baking powder, those ads keep appearing. Everyday life, everyday consumption just carries on. It provides this underlying stability.
Okay, final stretch. Mid to late September. What's the war news looking like now?
Still a mix. On the Eastern Front, things look good for the Allies. September 17th reports emphasize the magnitude of the Austrian defeat against Russia. Talk of 1,000 cannon captured, big numbers.
Sounds like a major victory. What about the West?
More complicated. The same issue mentions a lull in the fighting in France. But the French admit the Allies are making slow progress. However,
there's a catch.
The paper also notes the Germans had advanced rapidly, like 10 miles a day initially, and still hold a big chunk of northern France east of Paris. So it's looking more like a stalemate setting in. Tenacious German resistance.
A long, hard fight ahead, and the human cost keeps being highlighted.
Grimly so. That September 17th issue brings up this horrifying historical thing.
Yeah.
The Serbian Tower of Skulls.
What was that?
A monument built in 1800 using 1,200 skulls from defeated rebels. A really visceral reminder of war's brutality, past and present.
Ugh, ghastly. And connecting it to this war's casualties.
Yeah, the September 10th issue had already estimated over 100,000 German soldiers killed just in the first month or so. An unbelievable scale of loss.
Unimaginable. And the naval war continues its quiet threat.
Always there. September 10th reports a British minesweeper, the Kyrie, hit a mine in the North Sea. Sank in 3 minutes, 6 men missing. A reminder of the constant danger, even without big battles.
And the Equity even uses poetry to reflect on the war's impact.
It does, yeah. September 17th features a poem called The War. It personifies war as this destructive fierce, laughing at treaties, spreading hate, taking men from fields, stopping factories.
Wow, a really powerful emotional take on the broader consequences, beyond just the military stuff.
Exactly. Captures the social and economic disruption. And the paper keeps linking that back to Canada.
Like the canned vegetables.
Right, September 24th. Supplies of canned vegetable from France and Belgium are cut off, boosting demand for Canadian canning. Direct economic impact, creating local opportunities again.
And revealing dependencies, too, like with zinc.
Yeah, September 10th mentions zinc manufacturing. Turns out Canada relied heavily on Germany for it. The war exposed that vulnerability, forcing them to look elsewhere or develop their own sources.
And just the sheer scale of it all.
Is driven home by a statistic in the September 3rd issue. More than half of the people of the entire globe live under the flags of the belligerent powers.
More than half the world. Including the British Empire's 435 million people.
Makes it undeniably a world war, right from the start.
Yeah.
Not just Europe's fight.
Yet through all this, Pontiac keeps ticking.
Yeah.
The Shawville Fair is coming up.
And the September 17th paper expects it to be good, despite everything.
Okay.
A real symbol of community resilience, holding on to tradition. Attending the fair must have felt incredibly normal, comforting.
And the local shops are still advertising. Doors, wagons, horses, tailoring.
All still there in the paper. McCormick Ware Rooms, John L. Hodgson selling horses, S. Morehouse the tailor. Daily commerce had to go on. People needed stuff.
And some retailers were even using the war in their ads.
Cleverly, yeah. S.C. Hodgins and R.A. Drapeau advertising new fall clothes, hosiery, velveteen on September 10th at before the war prices.
Appealing to that desire for normalcy, maybe. Mm. Reassuring people some things hadn't changed yet.
Exactly. A smart bit of wartime marketing. Offering a little slice of the before times.
And the town council, the schools, they keep functioning.
Yep. September 10th has notices about tenders for school caretaking, tax collection reminders. The mundane, essential stuff of running a town just continues. The structures hold.
And maybe the most human detail of all.
Has to be the recipes, right? September 24th, right alongside the war news, you find instructions for making grape jelly or chill sauce.
It's amazing. Amidst global catastrophe, people are still preserving fruit.
It's about domestic routines, simple comforts, maybe finding solace in the familiar. Even when empires clash, the grapes still need to be turned into jelly. It's just life.
What an incredible journey that was, seeing those first few weeks of the Great War unfold, not on some grand stage, but right there in the pages of the Equity in Pontiac County.
It really brings it down to a human level, doesn't it? You see the massive global events, the declarations of war, the mobilization.
But right alongside it, the lawn socials, the harvest worries, the ads for baking powder, the fair still going ahead. That contrast is just so powerful.
The Equity really did capture both sides, the huge scale of the war, and its very intimate, local impact, a perspective you often miss in the big history books.
And this deep dive, it really shows how fast things changed, didn't it? How quickly this distant conflict started reshaping local life, the economy, jobs, people's anxieties about things like airships.
Absolutely. But also how much ordinary life just persisted. That resilience is striking too. So hopefully you listening have gained this unique ground level feel for that pivotal moment, seeing how a small Canadian town wrestled with a world turned upside down.
And thinking about the Equity back then being that main window onto the world for people in Pontiac, it leaves us with a thought, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Well, in our own time, we're just flooded with information, 247, from everywhere. How do we sort through it all? How do we tell the difference between the fleeting headlines and the things that will have a real, lasting impact?
That's a great question. How do we make sure we're truly well-informed, not just drowning in noise?
Exactly. What can a 100-year-old local newspaper from Pontiac teach us about consuming information today, about finding the real story amidst all the chatter? Something to think about.